The following talk was given by Randy Potterbaum at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 13, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
My talk this morning is about taking refuge in impermanence. The phrase taking refuge is something we're all familiar with. People have run across it in terms of its application in this practice. Probably most people here have taken vows that included taking refuge. Take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha. And it's probably also likely that everyone has a little different take on what that means to them, have a little personalized thought about what it means to take refuge. So for the sake of this talk, I'll tell you what my take on it is, what my thoughts about it is. And for me, taking refuge just means to take comfort, to have some peace of mind or some relief from suffering. And so when I say take refuge in impermanence, I really mean find some comfort in that teaching. And then we come to the term impermanence, which is a lot more complicated. Again, we've probably read lots of things about it. It's one of the fundamental teachings in this practice. But I think it's one of the teachings that really is prone to a lot of intellectualization, cognitive understanding. And that can be true of all the teachings, but in my opinion, it's a little more prevalent in our thoughts about impermanence. Part of that has to do with how we generally define things. If we think, for example, of how we would define the concept of light, we would do it through comparison and contrasting. You might develop this little ordinal scale, and one end is light, the other end is darkness, all these variations in between. And that helps us understand and communicate about light. Very helpful. Or if we want to understand an emotion such as happiness, probably develop that same scale. One end, happiness, the other end, unhappiness, all these variations in between. And actually with an emotion, there's probably more variations than we would think about when we describe light. And again, that's very helpful. It's the way we do it conventionally and the way our life is easier. And so then, of course, we come to impermanence. And there might be some tendency of also trying to do it in that same intellectualized or cognitive way. We might want to develop that ordinal scale on one end impermanence and the other end permanence. And of course, as we, you know, follow these teachings, we know that everything is impermanent, right? All of us are impermanent. Every object, every event, every phenomena, conditions arise and things manifest. We manifest, conditions change, and we no longer manifest. That's the nature. But when we think about it, we're certainly at risk for trying to have this intellectualized understanding, comparing it to something, contrasting it to something. And it's pretty hard not to do that. It's pretty hard not to think that there is impermanence and there is permanence. Again, that's that getting stuck in a cognitive, intellectual process. And as we know from the teachings, there's only impermanence. And that our thoughts, our mistaken views on impermanence are illusion or delusion. You know, whether there's really a difference, I suppose, doesn't matter. But for someone like me, there's a difference. If we think of something as being an illusion, we kind of recognize it, right? It's kind of a fleeting attention to something. And then we go, oh, yeah, I wasn't doing that accurately. When we think of something as a delusion, and of course this comes from background of mental health care, we think of it as just a fixed belief, right? That we absolutely believe that something is permanent. hard to give up any belief, whether it's about permanency or anything else. But it's pretty fixed. And we can get stuck in that kind of cognitive thinking. I'm going to talk a little bit at some point about the kind of habitual thinking about things. I'm not going to do it right now, but when we're thinking about things that are related to impermanence, we have to be very careful that we don't fall into that kind of traditional way of thinking about things, because it just doesn't work. It'll just leave us kind of churning and probably causing more distress. So what we need to do is then apply really critical thinking to looking at impermanence or any other of the teachings. And I think if we're trying to understand what critical thinking is, that's just using some objective analysis in a simple sense, something we do all the time. But it involves taking into account all the things that we know about something. And if we're talking about the reality of impermanence, we need to take into account all of the teachings. So we have to be very careful about that. And I think one of the advantages of practicing at a center like Dharmafield is if you get stuck in that intellectualized confusion, you can talk to one of the teachers. They'll help you with that. I think we have to be particularly careful about that when we're reading things, or maybe to a lesser degree when we're listening to talks about things. And that just comes from the nature of how we approach reading versus listening. There's very few people who hang on every word that's being spoken. I certainly don't do that. I might pretend to, and years of being a therapist, I got good at pretending to do that. But people don't do that. When you're listening to this talk, sometimes you're paying attention. Sometimes what I say might make sense, and you think about it a little bit. And while you're thinking about it, you're not paying attention to everything else that's being said. You might think what I'm saying is just a crock, and you're not listening to any of it, but that's just a normal process. And so when we're listening, it's pretty easy to not get caught up in things. But when it comes to written material, I think it's another story, because most things are written and edited to appeal to the reader. You know, they want someone to read it, and they want someone to accept what they're writing about. And when they get into Buddhist publications, then it has an additional level of credibility or authority. You have to think, well, if it's written in a book about Buddhism or any other publication about Buddhism, it's got to be right. But, you know, it's not right necessarily. You have to use that same critical thinking. And I'll talk just a little bit about an article that came to mind as I was putting this talk together. It's something I read, I don't know, a number of years ago. And it was in a newsletter from a Buddhist Meditation Center, not one from the Twin Cities. But because it was in that publication, it had some credibility just by the fact that it was there. And it was an article written by someone who had the opinion that what happened to people in early childhood had significant impact on how they were able to take up an understanding of impermanence. And that struck me as interesting for a number of reasons, but one of them is, as some of you know, I spent my whole adult life being a child and adolescent psychologist, so one of my beliefs is that what happens in childhood affects us throughout the rest of our life. So I read this article. It was very well written. And I don't remember the author's credentials, and it really doesn't matter. Only matters that it was in this publication. So he had a theory that really was presented as fact. And again, it's very interesting. He had the opinion that practitioners were divided into two groups in terms of how they could, how easy it was for them to understand impermanence. One group were people who had an idyllic childhood. And his definition, summary of it, was people who grew up with no distress, always nurtured, always supported, no trauma, no loss, no misery. And because of that, they were very uncomfortable with the concept of change or impermanence. So they had greater difficulty. Interesting theory, you know. And the other group of people were the practitioners who did not have an idyllic childhood, who had some distress, who, you know, there were gaps in nurturance, gaps in support, maybe had some loss, some trauma, felt rejected at times, were lonely at times. Essentially, what we would all think of as the normal vicissitudes of childhood, right? The normal experiences that you would have as a child. And so the author said, well, these people, it was much easier for them to understand impermanence because they grew up wanting things to change compared to the other group who never wanted anything to change. And very well written, interesting theory. I had a couple reactions to it. Well, the first one was, I better read it again because I'm missing something. So I read it again. I wasn't missing anything. My second reaction, I really need to clean up for a public talk, so I'll use Joe Biden's language. That article was just a bunch of malarkey, you know, which I hadn't heard that term malarkey for decades until Biden started using it, but I kind of like it, you know, I kind of like it. And it's more polite than what I would have said, what I really thought. And my third reaction, I can say this because it's my profession. I thought, oh, this is just another psychologist kind of going off the deep end with some theory that about psychology they're applying to this practice. So that aside, you know, this is really an opportunity to apply some critical thinking. And anyone among us who has any background in science or research knows it's pretty easy to construct, you know, a little study about that. So we could have to form the two groups, the idyllic childhood, the non-idyllic childhood. It'd have to be self-report, of course. And to get a sample out of the group of people who self-reported that they had their childhood was not idyllic, that they experienced some distress, some loss, some trauma, all those normal things, it'd be pretty easy. Because, you know, if you said raise your hand, if you had a non-idyllic childhood, almost everyone would raise their hand, right? Because that's just how things are. But being a self-report, you'd have to interview them to make sure it's true. And that'd be pretty simple, because when people report normal experiences, they're almost always telling the truth. Then you'd have to form this sample group of the other people who had or self-reported that they had an idyllic childhood. That'd be a smaller group, but probably some people would self-report. So again, you'd have to validate it by interviewing those people to see if in fact they had an idyllic childhood. My researcher bias aside, I think what you would come up with is that a certain subset of those people had a life that's characterized by minimization, denial, maybe some kind of histrionic subset. And so their reporting of having an idyllic childhood really wasn't valid. So you'd have to eliminate them. There probably would be a couple people or a few people who had no recollection of childhood. You know, maybe they had a traumatic brain injury or some horrible psychological trauma. So in compensation, they kind of created a fantasy of what their childhood was like, but it really wasn't idyllic, so you would eliminate them. And then, as anyone who's done research knows, when it has to do with self-report, there's a certain percentage of that population is lying about it. And so that's pretty obvious. So eventually, the author's entire premise would just implode because there's nobody in that idyllic childhood group. At least in all my contacts with people, I've never met anyone who had a perfect childhood. My point isn't really that article was a bunch of malarkey, which it is, of course. But it really, it's pretty easy to get caught up in kind of some intellectualized exercise about what this practice is, including what impermanence is. And we have to really be careful about that. Careful about what we think, careful about what we listen to, careful about what we read. And again, you know, when you practice here, or probably any other Zen center, if you're concerned about that, schedule a time with one of the teachers, and they will help you. One of the things that I do agree with from that article, excuse me, is that childhood experiences do affect us throughout our life. And I think that's true in terms of our thinking, our intellectual understanding of what might be permanent. One of the experiences, probably lots of experiences people have had, but one of them that you may have had, may have been at some point, and I'm not looking at anyone in particular, but at some point in your younger life, you might have committed some transgression, you know, some ill-advised behavior, or maybe you just failed to do something, one of the many failures in our lives. And as a result, you were found yourself being chastised by some authority figure and reading you the riot act. And typically the capping verse on that chastisement was you being told that this is going on your permanent record. And so you were probably quite distressed about that and worried about it and were thinking, oh man, I'm stained with this for the rest of my life. Maybe carried some of that anxiety into adulthood. Then you took up this practice and you got some relief. You realized you never had a permanent record. You know, just didn't exist. Your record was just like everything else, had the nature of impermanence. Besides, you know, I think if we recall those kind of events, in this case, probably that authority figure was trying to help you in some way, you know, trying to help you make some change, and maybe it worked out. Maybe it did. Maybe the result was the result of your fear that things would be permanent caused you to make some change in your behavior. And the other thing to, I think, to keep in mind is the person who, for the people who had this happen to them, the people who chastised you probably didn't have the same opportunity you had to understand the nature of impermanence, right? Of course, even if they did, what would they say? This is going on your impermanent record? It wouldn't have had the same impact, or it wouldn't have made, would have confused you, but not had the same impact. But, and so I'm going to just talk a little bit about experience I had not that long ago, but it pointed out the value of not taking just a cognitive approach to, well, not only this practice, but anything of meaning in your life. This is something that happened about 4 or 5 years ago. It was a couple years before COVID, back when people could meet in community without all of the impediments that come from dealing with the pandemic. I'm hoping we'll get back to that soon, but I was asked to sit in as a consultant with a self-harm support group. And for people who don't know what that means, a self-harm support group is comprised of people who suffer from addictions. Maybe they're addicted to alcohol, maybe to drugs, maybe they suffer from addiction to both. Typically people who have been through treatment a time or two, but unfortunately continue to abuse substances. Some of the group members had not been through treatment, but they were continuing to abuse drugs or alcohol. But the central theme is, among the people in the group, is an understanding that there is harm coming from their substance abuse. And so as the name implies, they want to do things to reduce the amount of harm. And it's a reasonable approach, but just to clarify, that's not treatment for chemical dependency. I don't want anyone to be confused. It's not a treatment approach. It's a treatment for drug or alcohol abuse and dependence happens in, you know, those empirically validated programs, things that, you know, inpatient, outpatient programs, happens through AA or NA or a combination of all those things. Those are the programs that, you know, have saved countless lives, right, and who probably improved the quality of life for many times that number. But that being said, the harm reduction model has its place. So the first two times they asked me to sit in was to help them process a death by overdose of one of the group members, which unfortunately is not an uncommon occurrence among that population. If you follow the statistics on that, you know that in 2020, actually the year ending in April of 2020, over 80,000 deaths by overdose were recorded in this country. And then the year ending April of 2021 was well over 100,000. And of course, that's undercount by far, because the only way you get on that list is if the coroner identifies your death as being solely caused by drug or alcohol overdose, mainly drug overdose, mainly opioid-based. And so it's just one of those tragedies that just keeps building. Unfortunately, as we know, there's the availability of opioids, particularly fentanyl, is just out of control. So I think there'll be a lot more overdoses, some intentional, some not, as a result. But anyway, the third group that I sat in on, I was just there to provide some general, like, mental health advice or recommendations. I wasn't there as a therapist, of course. And that group followed the more traditional model that it takes, which is members of the group talk about their substance dependence and their plans to reduce the harm from that dependence. The first young man who talked told a story. He had a significant dependence on opioids. He was living on the street, in and out of shelters, couldn't maintain employment, couldn't find a job, really, because he didn't have an address, was estranged from his family. Very sad situation. He presented a plan to reduce the frequency and the quantity of use. Logical plan. He was having zero success, which is frequently the case. As soon as he started using, he'd be back into that same pattern. But it's a support group, so people are offering him encouragement and advice and recommendations. And at one point, this older gentleman who was sitting next to me said to him, you know, that's a very good plan, but you're about 18 inches away from it working out. I had no idea what he meant, 18 inches away, but other people in the group knew what it meant. Maybe some of you do. They're going, yeah, and then, but it, that moment wasn't appropriate for me to ask what that meant, and it came up later in the group. People would talk about their plans, and yeah, you're about 18 inches away, so finally, I had an opportunity to ask what it meant, and some of the people looked at me kind of like incredulously, like, you don't know what that means? But the guy sitting next to me said, oh, he said, that's really simple. It's really simple. It's about 18 inches from your head to your heart, and as long as you keep that gap, nothing meaningful is ever going to happen. You won't change a damn thing in your life. And that has stuck with me. It's really a beautiful way of describing it. And it applies to everything, but it certainly applies to the practice. If we practice intellectually, if we don't have a wholehearted practice, nothing's going to come of it. It'll just be an exercise in futility. So if anyone's wondering, I'm probably about 18 inches away from waking up most of the time because I'm stuck up here. So I'm going to talk just, let me wet my throat here. I'm going to talk just a little bit about Buddhist teachings on impermanence. I'm not going to talk about it much in terms of the specific teachings because you're probably familiar with that. But when I think about it or any of the teachings, I always want to start by where it began and what's the origin of that teaching. And as we know, the origin was when the historical Buddha had his realization about the true nature of existence or his enlightenment and got up from his cushion or the ground wherever he was sitting And when I started telling everybody about that path, and the first thing he taught was very simple, right? There's suffering and there's relief from suffering. And every one of the teachings, they flow from that. They all go back to that understanding. If we're reading sutras, reading articles, books about impermanence, that's the heart of that teaching, right? When we take up the understanding of our true nature of impermanence, there will be a reduction in suffering. As you kind of read things, you might run across a statement that impermanence is one of the three characteristics of all existence, the three marks of that of existence. And along with impermanence is, of course, the understanding or the reality that there is no separate, individuated, persistent self. And the third one is that there's dukkha, which we translate as suffering or discontent or dissatisfaction. And suffering, of course, is not a random event, right? It doesn't just happen. It's not a punishment for our personal failings or a sign of our moral weakness, right? It's just the natural consequence of us ignoring the reality of life. As long as we ignore impermanence, as long as we ignore any reality of life, we'll continue to suffer. When we understand those realities, there's a chance for reduced suffering. Of course, those teachings were a pretty significant departure from the religious beliefs of that time and place. Revolutionary, really, in the sense of understanding the true nature of existence. I always think of the teaching that was really socially revolutionary, probably raised more concerns among the officials of that time. If the Buddha said, well, you know, your nature is impermanent and there's no separate self, that's probably not going to trouble the authorities, the people in charge of things, meaning religiously in charge. But then he also said that everyone had equal opportunity to wake up. Everyone had the same opportunity to realize their true nature. And that was pretty revolutionary from a social point of view, because as we know, that was a time when the belief was, first of all, it was a very hierarchical system, very patriarchal, and the only people who were candidates for spiritual awakening were the people in that top caste, you know, the Brahmins or the gurus or the priest. And everyone else, the rest of us, we were out of luck, right? We would have had the hope that, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 incarnations down the road, we'd make it into that top caste and have an opportunity to wake up. And of course, the Buddha said, oh, that's malarkey, probably not the word to use. But, everyone has the same opportunity. I might have to read a little bit of this, but this is it's not a quote from the Buddha, but it's something frequently said that the Buddha taught. And what he taught was that one source of human suffering and discontent is that we grasp or cling to things of this world under the mistaken view that they will last forever. Of course, as we know, nothing does. We don't last forever. Nothing lasts forever. We manifest when conditions are right. We cease to manifest when they change. When we understand those, and really understand those teachings, then we're not troubled by it. We have an opportunity for some peace of mind, some comfort. The other thing you might run across when you're reading about impermanence is this idea that you have to understand, or if you want, you have to understand impermanence before you can understand any of the other teachings. I've run across this a number of times, and maybe I'm just confused about it, but that wouldn't be my opinion, right? It's not a sequence of learning. We learn things sequentially because you have to start somewhere. If you take classes about Buddhism, you'll probably start with the Four Noble Truths and you'll expand from that. But It's not that you learn one thing and move to the other. It's one body of wisdom, right? It's one teaching, right? It's just reality. It's that teaching. And if you fully understand the true nature of impermanence, you probably fully understand the true nature of everything. And if you understand emptiness, you understand impermanence. So many times I've run across that. And if I understand it properly, it's kind of this idea that there is, and it's an intellectual approach, that there's a sequence of understanding or a sequence of waking up. And I just say, I don't think it's true. You know, I think that that's where you get caught up in kind of that, just thinking about it, just having a probably mistaken cognitive view about it. Some of the other things that you probably noticed when you were studying about impermanence is that it's not a doctrine, right? It's not a set of rules that the historical Buddha or anyone else created. It's not a theoretical construct. You know, it's not part of some theory on existence. It's not the philosophy. It's not, you know, part of the philosophy of the meaning of life. You also probably noticed at some point that impermanence really doesn't belong to Buddhism, right? It's not Buddhist, right? It's not any religion. It's not any spiritual practice. Impermanence is not defined by any of those things or contained in any of those things or limited by them or expanded upon by them. It's just how it is. Impermanence is just reality. It's just how things are. It's no more complicated than that, right? And it couldn't be simpler than that. It's just reality. And that means we have to let go of all of our ideas about what it's like or what it's not like. Because it's just reality. It's just that simple. I just want to, again, mention a couple of things by one of the Buddhist teachers, because I think it's important in any talk, and I'll reference a couple of things attributed to Dogen, someone who we're all probably familiar with, you know, a man who lived 13th century, I believe, highly regarded in the Zen Buddhist tradition, prolific writer, one of the more prominent teachers historically. And one of the things attributed to him, this is a quote, I mean, translated English, of course, said that he wrote, impermanence is itself Buddha nature. Very straightforward, very simple. Impermanence is just your nature. It's not more than that, it's not less than that. And in order to understand it, you have to let go of all the ideas about it being separate from or a thing or different from something else. It's just our nature. One other thing that he pointed out, and this is not a quote from him, from his writings or translation, just as someone's take on it. Dogen apparently pointed out that impermanence isn't a problem to overcome on the path. He said it is the path. He said that practice, that our practice isn't a way to cope with or overcome impermanence. It's a way to fully appreciate and live with it. When I read that, I think, well, Dogen's probably talking to the people in the 13th century who had a mistaken view of impermanence. They thought that it was a problem, right? It was a difficulty. It was an obstruction. And he was trying to help them let go of those mistaken views. And probably talking to us, we may hold the same mistaken views, that impermanence is just impermanence. It's not anything else. And that means to understand it, you have to really let go of all the ideas that it's anything else, such as a blockade of some kind or an object to overcome. But there's lots of reasons we do that, right? There's lots of reasons that we like to think that way. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about our inclination towards having maybe mistaken views or thoughts about impermanence. And this is not from Buddhist text or scripture. This is from psychology, meaning Western psychology, or maybe social psychology, certainly biology, certainly things related to evolution. And this is an intellectual discussion about these things, but I think it has some merit. One of the things that we know about everyone, people who live now, people who lived, 10,000 years ago, is that we desire happiness and comfort. We want things to be predictable. We want to avoid the opposite. And that just makes sense. Like, who would want to be unhappy or uncomfortable? And that's not the case in life. We want things to be pleasant. We want things to remain the same, to be stable. And that is really our desire for permanence. We want things to always be the way they are or the way we want them to be. And when that doesn't happen, which is the case for probably most of us, then we have just increased suffering. From that psychological or biological perspective, that desire for things to stay the same for security is something that's been hardwired in us forever. Humans who lived 100,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago had the same desire. It's been passed on to us. That desire, on some level, was part of the species surviving. The species had to have some interest in happiness, comfortableness, all those kind of things. Otherwise, it would have just ended. There would be no reason to continue propagating the species if everyone was unhappy and miserable all the time. Those are the, I think sometimes they're referred to as the gifts from our ancestors. Those instinctual things that we carry on now that were the same as people had 10,000 years ago. Sometimes I think they're mistakenly referred to as primitive instincts, and I think that's just us thinking that somehow we're a more evolved people than people who lived 10,000 years ago. In reality, we're just the same. I mean, we know different things. We know more things. We live probably much more comfortably, but we're basically the same. And the result of that evolutionary process is that we like to have everything under control. We want everything to be predictable, or at least we want them to have the appearance or the illusion of predictability. If you use more traditional Buddhist language to describe that phenomena, we might say that we all may want to have all the conditions of our lives under our control. We want to be in charge of all the myriad of conditions that affect us. But as we know, we're not in charge of the conditions of life, right? Those conditions have their own natural course and they follow that course. Our only job is to adapt to all of those variations, to those conditions. They follow their own natural laws. So I'm going to talk just about a couple of aspects of that cognitive approach, or that maybe better described as biological evolutionary approach, that present as impediments to understanding impermanence. And one of them is fairly benign. That's really the busyness or the complexity of our lives. Most of us have very busy lives. Get to be my age and retire, it's not quite as busy. But people worry about jobs. They worry about school. They worry about taking care of their families, their spouses, their children. People worry about finances, worry about global warming, all kinds of things, worry about the pandemic. And as a result, we can have kind of a narrowing of focus where we notice everything around us is changing. And yes, everything around us is impermanent, but somehow we see ourselves as not changing. We're kind of the one solid thing in the universe and everything else is changing. Of course, we don't think that way, at least I don't think we do. If someone were to ask me, do you think that you're the one unchanging phenomena in the whole universe? I'd, of course, say no. Even if I thought that was true, I'd say no, because You have to be embarrassed to say something like that. But a lot of times we think that way. And again, we're thinking on what I would call kind of a subconscious level. We're not officially thinking that we're not changing. But then, you know, there's always things that kind of bring us back, fortunately. Common experience might be if you reconnect with people you haven't seen for a very long time, like say you're attending a class reunion, people you haven't seen for a decade or 20 or 30 years. And so you're kind of reconnecting with these people and they're telling their stories and you're telling your own little enhanced story about your life. Pretty pleasant. In the back of your mind, though, you're having these thoughts like, man, time was not kind to so-and-so, or, you know, so-and-so didn't age very well, or, gee, he or she really let himself or herself go. You don't say these things, of course, because that would be rude, but kind of that little self-satisfied thinking happens, and then later you probably find yourself in the restroom, and you're washing your hands in the mirror, and you look up, and then it dawns on you, you know, all those little snarky, judgmental thoughts you were having, everyone else was having the same damn thoughts about you. You know, it kind of brings us back to the reality of we're just part of that big situation. And again, that I think is a pretty gentle or benign issue. I think the most consistent distraction to understanding the true nature of impermanence, and one that is probably less recognized, is just basically fear we have about change. And we know fear is a pretty strong motivation, right? And we all are familiar with it. We've been afraid of things. We know how it works. We know that it's on a spectrum. It's a wide range. On one end is, you know, extreme fear. And the other end's very subtle. On the extreme end, you know, we don't have to experience that very often, fortunately, but if we do, we know that there's a strong evolutionary base, survival base, biological response, right? There's a surging of adrenaline and other hormones that, you know, our senses become more acute. We focus better visually and auditorily. Our muscles tense up in preparation for defense. We are formulating a plan of defense. That's typically what people would refer to as, you know, fight or flight phenomena. I think that's an accurate depiction, although some people in situations of extreme fear panic, but most people, they do one or the other. And again, our lives are not such that we experience that very often. You know, we think of our ancestors from, you know, 50,000 years ago. They probably experienced it a lot. You know, my guess is they didn't have the kind of safety and security that we experience. Or if we think of people who live in war-torn countries, they probably have that phenomenon quite often. But we don't, in our comfortable lives, we don't have to deal with that much. But you can imagine how it works, right? If, say, you're out on vacation and you're hiking through the wilderness somewhere and you hear this little ominous rattle in front of you and you look down, there's a rattlesnake there. You're going to have that response, right? You're going to have that fight or flight response to an acute danger. I would recommend actually flight over fight in that situation, but that's not really what I'm talking about. The impediment is not on that extreme end. It's on the other end. It's on the subtle end of fear that doesn't present with biological changes. It presents with maybe avoidance or repression or suppression of thought or emotion about change. It happens when we are in the habit of thinking about change or impermanence as being a problem. It's something that's painful. It's a loss. You know, or we think that somehow we're wounded by the normal changes in life, but impermanence. And it becomes really our way of responding to it. And again, it's at a very low level. It's not a conscious level at some point. It just becomes habit. It's an habitual response. I'll talk about habit in just a minute here. But that tendency or that habit runs pretty deep in us, right? Because it is on that evolutionary biological level, just part of our efforts to survive. And we can very easily kind of get caught up in not paying attention to our lives. And so, you know, our capacity to really appreciate or understand the impermanence of existence gets lost in that. Because it, when we have thoughts about it, and again, I don't mean we're sitting down officially thinking about it, but when those thoughts come up, we habitually just kind of brush them aside, you know, and it only is when we pay very close attention to what we're doing, and that's, of course, things that are taught in this practice. Pay very close attention to all the things that are happening in your life that you can actually notice that. And, of course, it's, you know, it happens more on in more dramatic situations. People who worry about dying, you know, they're on that dramatic end, you know, they don't want to think about it. They habitually avoid the process of thinking about death. And of course, you know, there are people who get into thinking that impermanence really equates to not surviving. And this is, I think, on a pretty kind of subconscious level that it exists. And of course, that in a sense, that's true, right? I mean, we are impermanent and we're not going to survive forever. But the threat of not surviving doesn't happen on a moment-to-moment basis, right? It doesn't, it's not happening every day. You know, that's an abstract kind of thing. So we have to be very careful that we don't get caught up in habitually thinking about or not thinking about those kind of things. So then the question is, what do we do? And I would say what we do is we follow the teachings to just pay attention to your life. So I'm going to just spend a few minutes talking, kind of finishing up the biology part of this and actually finishing the talk. And that's the biology of habit formation. Every time we have a response, and if it's the same response to the same situation, that response follows a certain neurological pathway, right? Certain neurochemicals are excited. And every time we have the same response, it follows that same pathway. And so it enhances it. It becomes a habit, really. It becomes the easy way out. It's the path of least resistance. Some stimulus comes up, we respond to it, and we respond in the same way. The more we do it, the more unconscious, in a sense, it occurs. And so if we have a fear of change or impermanence, and our response is always to avoid it, we're going to develop a habit of avoiding it. And it takes great effort to change that habit, great effort to notice it. Some habits we notice, or response habits we notice more easily. If you're someone who's easily agitated or you get anxious very easily, you know what happens when your agitation or anxiety is triggered, right? You can predict 100% what's going to happen. It'll run the same course, you know the outcome, and it's only if you increase your awareness and make a change initially that you can change that habit. And I'm not saying habits are bad things, right? We have to have untold numbers of habits just to live our life. Otherwise, we'd be spending every minute trying to figure things out. We don't do that. You know, we get up, we put on our shoes. We don't think about that. And there's a lot of very positive things associated with habit formation. In addition to changing, you know, the way we respond. You may know someone who is always kind or always thoughtful. And my guess is you admire that person, right? I mean, that's a wonderful quality in a person. But you might think about them, well, it's just their nature to always be kind and thoughtful, which in fact is true. It is their nature, but it's their nature from, again, the biological perspective. It's the nature that they nurtured and they developed over years of practicing being kind and thoughtful. They enhanced those neural pathways that allowed them to initially respond to any situation by being kind and thoughtful. Very positive thing. Required dramatic effort. We shouldn't underestimate the people who do that, because obviously it's wonderful practice. One other biological process that has to do with this practice is related to your meditation. Now, when you went to meditation instruction, one of the things that the instructor said to you is, you know, you should have regularity in practice. You should do it on a regular basis. Set up a schedule and stick to that schedule. And there's lots of very important reasons for that, right? Lots of reasons. But one of the reasons, from a biological perspective, is habit formation, right? Regularity allows you to actually engage in meditation. If you noticed your meditation, maybe over months or years or decades, you probably saw a few things. One of them is when you sit on the cushion or on the chair, you might spend less time daydreaming over time. You might worry less about what's going to happen after meditation. You might spend less time complaining to yourself about little aches and pains that you're having. You might spend less time waiting for the bell to ring. You know, this comes from the regularity of it. And what happens, of course, is that when you engage in that regular intentional practice, you end up being able to spend more time fully appreciating meditation, just sitting on the cushion, just letting all the rest of things go and just fully engaged in sitting on the cushion. And that is complicated, but from one end, it is really comes from practice, the biology of practice. There might be some people who are able to, the first time they sit down in meditation, fully engage themselves, but that's not me, and it's not anyone I've talked to. It requires that habit formation process. So, well, I had a few more things to say, but I'm not going to get into it just because we're running out of time. So if there's any comments or questions, I could take those. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.